Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, but my eyes are like a telescope. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we're so glad to have Lauren back with us this time.
Oh, thank you, Joe. Yeah, I believe while I was out, you guys talked about telescopes.
We did, but we didn't finish talking about them.
That's right. So without you, Lauren, we recorded the first part of a podcast episode about telescopes. And today we're going to tackle part two. So what did we talk about last time? We sort of started with some musings about the history of telescopes and what they mean to us. The fact that they're not just for creating images that are pleasing to the eye, but they're actually very important scientific instruments. They give us knowledge that's very useful for determining our place in the universe and learning things that we couldn't otherwise know.
Yeah, like being able to confirm the fact that the Earth is not the center of the universe.
Right, that was one of the things.
That was a good one. Yeah.
Pretty good. Well, I mean, there were a lot of different lines of evidence that eventually converged to disprove the geocentric model,
sure,
the idea that everything revolves around the Earth.
But being able to see stuff in outer space certainly helped.
Right. Yeah. So when Galileo looked through his telescope and saw moons orbiting Jupiter and saw the phases of Venus and things like that, that was some good evidence. Okay, really, it seems like we're all going around the sun instead of it all going around us. And that trend has continued. So we saw how the Hubble telescope helped us narrow down the age of the universe, and how other telescopes have taught us all kinds of things about our whole model of cosmology, the history of the universe, where we all come from.
Yep.
And now we want to take where we've gone and project forward.
Right. So we're looking into the future of telescopes. We're going to be talking about some telescopes that are in various stages of being constructed. Some of them are just in the concept stage, haven't been built at all. Some of them are space-bound telescopes. Some of them are here on Earth, or will be here on Earth.
Yeah, and I think, and hopefully y'all will agree with me, I think it is best to start with the good old James Webb Space Telescope, because I think this is one of the coolest things going on in science today.
Right. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, this is sort of the successor to the Hubble, right?
Right. It's the next generation space observatory.
And it's really meant to gaze further than the Hubble ever could, and we all hope that the mirrors aboard the James Webb will be properly installed and properly formed, because we talked in the last episode about how the Hubble famously had an aberration on its primary mirror.
A multi-billion-dollar aberration.
Yeah.
So we had to send up service missions to repair the Hubble telescope to get it working in proper order. But that might not be so much an option with the James Webb Space Telescope because, well, a couple reasons. Number
one, the space shuttle program being shelved is a big one.
That's one of them. The other one being that James Webb Space Telescope is not going to be easily accessible because it's not going to be in low Earth orbit.
No, this is a large infrared telescope with a 6.5 meter primary mirror. And, you know, it's supposed to look at everything from the beginning of the universe up to present day, like to really look at not just how conditions were moments after the Big Bang, but how the universe evolved over time. How did galaxies form? How did stars form?
Right, because you have to remember, when you use a telescope that can see as far as these space telescopes can, you're essentially using some kind of visual time machine.
Yeah, you're looking back in time.
That's exactly right, because light only travels at a certain speed.
Yeah, the speed of light, as it turns out.
Exactly. So when you peer across the galaxy, you're not seeing things happening in real time.
Right.
You're seeing the light that left those things as far away as they are, and it's taken all this time
for that
cross,
light to reach us.
Exactly,
yeah.
To cross the distance in between to reach you.
Right.
So the farther and farther you peer out into the universe, the further and further back you're seeing in time.
Yeah, for example, I mean, if you were to look at the sun, don't look at the sun.
Never look directly into the sun.
But if you were, you know how far back that goes, right?
About 10 minutes?
It's eight minutes. Yeah. It takes about 8 minutes for light from the sun to reach the Earth. So you are actually looking back in time by 8 minutes. You're not looking at where the sun is now or how the sun appears now. You're looking at how the sun appeared 8 minutes ago. So same sort of idea, except you just extend it. And the further out you go, the further back in time you're looking.
Yeah, so the Hubble has been able to show us some really amazing ancient stuff, like early galaxies in the ultra deep field. This stuff's really exciting. The James Webb Space Telescope is going to let us see even further back.
Right. And it's the design is really neat. The primary mirror actually is segmented and can fold up.
It's hexagonal segments.
So the cool thing about it is that it can be folded for launch because obviously this is a very delicate instrument and launch. I don't know if you guys know this, but if you were to strap a lot of rocket fuel to your bottom and then push yourself up into space by lighting said rocket fuel, it's a bit of a bumpy ride.
It's pretty hardcore. It's the most metal of all launches.
It is.
It makes even astronauts puke.
Yes.
Astronauts are the best people at not puking. Like, of all the people in a not puking contest, they would be at the top. They'd be the winners.
So in the puking spectrum,
they are trained.
They are close to zero puke.
Right. They're the least pukey, but sometimes even they puke.
Whereas babies would be way on the other end of that spectrum.
Right. Yeah, they'd be high puking coefficient.
Possibly only exceeded by the young girl in The Exorcist. But anyway,
that's not her fault. She's possessed.
I didn't say it was her fault. I was merely saying.
Okay.
But
well,
at any rate,
it is a very bumpy ride. And telescopes, of course, the mirrors, the huge mirrors that we use to create gigantic reflecting telescopes, optical and infrared, like the James Webb is going to be, are very delicate.
Yes. And the James Webb telescope will have four instruments aboard it: the near infrared camera, or NIRCam, the near infrared spectrograph, or NIRSpec, the mid infrared instrument, MIRI, and then finally, the fine guidance sensor / near infrared imager and slitless spectrograph, or Figus NIRIS. Yeah, that one does not go into acronym form very
Figus
easily.
Figus Nerus.
I don't know.
He was one of my favorite Roman emperors.
Figus Nerus. Yeah. Didn't he play fiddle while Rome just smoldered
a little
bit?
While the fig tree burned.
Yeah. Well,
so what ranges of light is this thing going to be detecting?
From 0.6 to 28 micrometers in wavelength. So, 0.6, by the way.
What does that mean? Those are just some numbers.
So a micrometer is essentially 1,000 nanometers.
Yeah.
Right? So if you look at the spectrum of light and you look at the different wavelengths, and you look at 600 nanometers, that would be 0.6 micrometers. That's how far down in the visible spectrum this will be able to look. And that's somewhere in the orange/red area.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you think of your Roy G. Biv, your longer wavelengths are on the Roy side. So it's not going to be able to see anything from yellow on.
Okay.
But red and orange it will be able to look at, as well as infrared. And keep in mind, we mentioned this in our previous episode when we talked about infrared telescopes. The data that we get from these, often we end up putting it through some sort of visualization software so that we add color that we can actually perceive.
Yeah. Right, which is easier for us to look at.
Yeah, you see these amazing, gorgeous pictures of space, like the amazing nebula.
Oh, right. Anything from a nebula or a supernova that you've ever seen has been basically an artist's rendition of figuring out what those wavelengths would be, sort of scaling it, you know, like if you've ever done music and you know how to scale octaves down or up, then
right.
It's similar.
Though I do want to clarify, based on artist rendition, that doesn't just mean like a guess. I mean,
it's a very scientific process of guessing.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's essentially you take the data you have and you extrapolate from it in order to get us an image that we can perceive.
I mean,
if you could see infrared, you would be able to tell already.
And I'm just saying that the really pretty colors are specifically chosen.
Yes.
For reasons. I mean, in addition to being mathematically sound, because they are really pretty.
That's true.
Both at the same time.
That's true.
Yeah, so we mentioned it's going to be looking at some of the earliest things in the universe. What does this really mean? So we're saying it's peering beyond where the Hubble's seen, beyond the ultra-deep field, way, way back in time into, I guess, beyond the first billion years of the universe's existence, right? Way into the past.
Right.
What's it going to see?
So you kind of need to know a little bit about the Big Bang Theory for this to make sense. But in for a good long while, compared to what the time scale that we humans are used to, I mean, it's a blink of an eye in the galactic time scale, but a good long while, energy and matter were all kind of one thing. It was the universe was extremely dense, so dense that light could not pass through it. Then it eventually expanded out, and once it expanded out and you started getting some cooling and you had energy and mass separating out, you started to have the formation of stars and galaxies.
And it's that first generation of stars that we're looking for with James Webb, right?
Yeah, we're really looking at more about the formation of the earliest galaxies.
Yeah.
But yes,
yeah,
you know, those would be, of course,
which contain stars.
Yeah, the earliest stars.
Probably. They weren't made of cotton candy.
So yeah, it's
maybe we'll find out.
But yeah, it's a really exciting idea. The idea of being able to get a closer look at these conditions, because a lot of this just exists right now in the realm of a hypothesis or theory, where we have done the calculations and we know what we expect to find, but this will be the actual finding.
Yeah.
So that's always exciting because
that whole testing hypotheses through observation.
Exactly.
Right.
And
yeah.
It may turn out that we see things we didn't expect, which means we have to adjust what we believe, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what scientists absolutely love, or at least I think the theoretical ones do.
Right. Right. Okay. So these mirrors that we're talking about, I mean, is it the same stuff that's in my bathroom mirror? What's up with these guys?
No. So the James Webb Telescope, we mentioned it has interlocking hexagonal mirrors, and that's so it can sort of fold out of its cocoon like a butterfly when it reaches the place in space where it needs to be. But the mirrors are made out of beryllium.
Okay.
Like
that stuff. I mean, you don't want to go breathing a lot of beryllium dust. That's about all I knew about beryllium.
Yeah, I know nothing about beryllium.
I have no practical.
I keep wanting to say beryllium sphere, but I'm almost certain that was in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, it reminds.
I think it's actually from what's that movie with Tim Allen and.
Oh, Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
It always reminds me of Sailor Moon. So.
All right.
Oh, okay.
Anyway. Well, let's talk about some actual science.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, why beryllium for the mirrors? Well, there are a lot of properties about beryllium that make it a really good idea to use it in these mirrors. Number one, it's very light and it's strong for its weight. But the telescope's mirror also has to hold its shape at the cryogenic temperatures in deep space. So this is going to be like negative 400 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 240 degrees C. At these extreme temperatures, most materials are going to contract or change their volume.
Which is bad news if you're talking about something that is going to allow you to get a look at a distant universe. If the shape changes, then clearly that was like one of the issues with the Hubble. It wasn't
right.
It wasn't that the mirror's shape changed, but because of that aberration, we didn't get those clear pictures we were expecting.
Yeah. And if you don't remember from last episode, the fraction by which it was off was like some sliver of a human hair's width.
Yeah.
Of
and yet it was 10
off.
Times beyond the accepted range of error. So
yeah.
We're talking about an incredibly thin margin of error here.
Yeah, creating these telescopes requires some really precision engineering.
Yeah. So if the stuff deforms, that would be bad, but beryllium wouldn't do that?
Well, it will deform because pretty much all materials will. But beryllium holds up pretty well comparatively. It will still deform, so the project engineers, they were designing these mirrors, they had to test cool them to the temperatures that they'll experience in deep space.
Mm-hmm.
So they test them, they cool them down to those temperatures, record the magnitude of the changes, and then pre-correct for those temperature-based changes when polishing
great.
The mirrors in the final stages of design.
Look at them thinking.
Yeah.
I imagine they must have used liquid nitrogen will only get you down so cool. They must have had to use liquid helium to do that.
I really don't know what they use. I mean, yeah. I think they had to send them off to a separate facility for the cooling
test. I imagine so. Your average freezer does not get down to minus 400 degrees
right.
Fahrenheit.
So anyway, what I'm trying to convey is that getting something like this to work is a marvel of modern science. It is a lot of work. Even the smartest people among us are having to do really hard work to make this work right. And I think they deserve mega respect for what they're doing.
Absolutely. And they're also, you know, one of the other things the James Webb Telescope's going to be looking for, we're going to be talking a lot about in this episode, which is that it's going to look for the physical and chemical properties of exoplanets.
Yes.
And the hope there is that we might be able to discover exoplanets that are either already a habitat for life or could be a potential habitat some
for
point
us.
In the future.
Yeah.
So it's not the only space telescope out there that's going to be doing this, or even, I mean, there are some terrestrial ones that are going to be looking for planets that could potentially support life as well. One of the other ones is the Advanced Technology Large Aperture Space Telescope.
Yeah, I've heard of this. So basically, this is a proposal that is for the farther future that goes even beyond the James Webb, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's an optical telescope, so we're still talking about looking for light, whether it's...
The visible spectrum.
Yeah, yeah. Well, or it could be infrared. I mean, yeah. You know, optical does not necessarily mean that it's not infrared, but it does... It isn't looking for radio signatures or X-rays mm-hmm. or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still in the design phase. And it's supposed to look for the presence of life, among other things, on distant planets and to remove all ambiguity about it. You know, we often hear about exoplanets being discovered. And then through analysis, we try to kind of determine what sort of chemicals might or might not be present on that planet. This is supposed to be a telescope that'll be powerful enough for us to get those answers without us saying, well, it probably, maybe. Because, you know, a lot of those, upon further study, end up not panning out, or it turns out that we didn't have a good enough picture of what we were looking at. In some cases, we have exoplanets that, you know, quote-unquote exoplanets that we have identified that have since disappeared, which may mean that the original detection was an aberration itself. So this is really meant to take all that away.
It's hard to draw complex conclusions based on very limited data.
Exactly. And it really does hammer home the fact that we have to be careful about these kind of conclusions. And for those of us in this room, we have to be careful when we're reporting upon it to make sure that we add that critical thinking layer and say, this is what it appears to be, but keep in mind that until we have further observations, we cannot be sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just me trying to remind myself to to practice good
journalistic
down. Skills.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So the acronym here is ATLAST, which just makes me think of Ella Fitzgerald songs. But
in fact, that's all it's going to be playing deep in space. So if you were able to put your ear right up against it, you're like, ATLAST.
No, sing the whole song.
No, I'm not going to sing the whole song. You already made fun of me.
You got to go to the end.
You made fun of me for singing Oh Susanna earlier. So,
listeners, you need to know this. Jonathan Strickland knows the other stanzas to Oh Susanna. He knows the ones beyond the first.
Not only is he a terrific podcaster.
What you're telling them is that I know the verses, not just the chorus.
Oh, yeah, that might be right. Anyway, that's beside the point. Let's talk about telescopes.
Okay, well, all right. So,
what's the deal with ATLAST?
Well, it's another NASA project. It's through the Space Telescope Science Institute, which also does, it did run the Hubble program, and it's running the James Webb Space Telescope program as well. And like you guys said, it's still in the design stage. The hope is that it would be launching somewhere around like 2025 to 2035. So it's still pretty far out from the current day. And they're entertaining three different mirror types right now, aiming for less complexity and or mass than the Hubble and James Webb, but with better angular resolution and sensitivity.
That's cool.
Like as much as like 2,000 times the sensitivity
That's
of
amazing.
The Hubble.
So it would be able to detect much fainter bodies than either the James Webb. That'll become important too. We'll be talking about some telescopes that are going to be looking for stuff that a lot of other telescopes will miss, but we really, really need to know about them.
right. Yeah, you had a note in here about how it's going to be looking for biosignatures of life.
It's like things like molecular oxygen, water, and methane.
That's crazy.
This is the sort of stuff that, you know, again, we've looked at like spectral analysis of exoplanets and said, oh, this might be methane on this planet, which would be a biosignature that would be an indication that there's some form of organic life there. Not necessarily the only source of it.
I feel like I'd heard that about oxygen.
Yeah. So,
I mean, because at least we know about Earth that Earth didn't have an oxygen atmosphere until it was created by, I believe it was
life.
Cyanobacteria.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then if you remember, we've had some close calls with detecting methane on nearby bodies not that long ago that did not pan out for us. You remember hearing about Mars and the supposed detection of methane?
Did we bring it with us?
Yes, we brought it with us. That was the problem. So now in the case with telescopes, we don't have to worry about that because we're just looking. We're not actually sending a probe there that could potentially end up
contaminating
the sample. Exactly.
Yeah. One interesting thing that I was reading about when I read about this that I hadn't particularly thought about before, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier about launching. So one of the things that the designers have to think about is how to get these giant suckers into space. So two of their mirror concepts here are hypothetically compatible with another thing that doesn't exist yet, which is NASA's proposed Space Launch System, or SLS. And the third, which I think is not really their favored design, mm-hmm. would be able to go up on one of the U.S. Air Force Department of Defense evolved expandable launch vehicles, like the Delta IV and the Atlas V, which are currently in use.
Yeah.
So,
and we may also see something like SpaceX step up and design either a vehicle specifically for these or modifying one of their existing designs to allow for this kind of thing. Because we're already seeing that sort of a collaboration in getting astronauts to space. That was a pretty recent discussion where NASA said that a SpaceX capsule would soon be taking astronauts up to the International Space Station, which is pretty exciting stuff. So we may see that as well. It's always kind of terrifying to me whenever I read about one of these really cool projects that is proposed and not yet developed that is going to depend upon another really cool project that is proposed but not yet developed. Because if one or the other falls through, then you don't have your project.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, it just added another interesting layer of it to me, which I guess is, of course, if you really think about it, it's obvious. But, you know, sitting there and saying like, well, so what we're going to do with this extremely expensive, like $1 billion, highly precise mirror, we're going to strap a lot of rocket fuel to it.
Yeah.
And then we're going to light a fire in the rocket fuel.
It's sounding a lot like a Mythbusters episode right now. Like, we built this amazing thing. How do we blow it up? Now, the next one I wanted to talk about.
No, I imagine they're saying, just kidding, we're going to hand it over to the Russians.
Good old Soyuz. The Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, which I just like that acronym. So TESS is scheduled to launch in the near future and will perform a survey of the sky in search of habitable planets in the Goldilocks zone. So that's in that zone of orbits that we believe would be conducive to supporting life based upon what we know from our sample size of one planet that has life on it that we know of. And then also just looking for exoplanets in general. So it will cover 400 times more area than the Kepler-37b telescope, which also is known for looking for exoplanets.
Okay, so this is sort of an exoplanet hunter that's designed to cast a wide net.
Yes. Yeah, to really, because, you know, we have ideas of how many exoplanets must be out there based upon the information we've discovered from the ones we've seen, right?
Yeah,
we
right now the guess that. Is a lot.
Yeah, like tons of them. And this would help us either verify that or refute that. And both of those would be important. So,
oh, yeah. Exciting either way.
Yep. And then we have the European Extremely Large Telescope.
I added that because I love that name.
That's the European, extremely large.
The European Extremely Large Telescope.
It sounds like something out of Douglas Adams, doesn't it?
It makes the European Large.
No, it totally does.
The European Large Telescope has got terrible envy of the Extremely Large Telescope.
Well,
oh,
even the
very inadequate.
The European Very Large Telescope has got to feel a little threatened.
It's kind of feeling a little bummed. Well, right now it's still doing pretty well because this is the one that hasn't been built yet. Now, this is
after this comes the European hilariously large telescope.
The ludicrously large telescope, yeah. When you notice that the Earth's orbit has been slightly altered due to the presence of the telescope there.
Well, this is actually an Earth-based telescope, right?
Yeah.
Which, while they suffer some disadvantages compared to space telescopes. Obviously, they have to deal with the atmosphere
right.
and things like that. But they also have advantages in that they're right here and we can work on them.
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
easier to build and get in place.
Right. We don't have to worry about space junk.
Yeah.
Encountering one. We don't. And if something does go wrong, like you say, we could have maintenance and repair there immediately as opposed to, well, now we have to plan a mission. We have to train people. We have to get them up into space and then we have to figure out how to get them back down safely. I mean, that's anytime you're talking about any kind of space mission that's a maintenance issue, it's a huge endeavor. And of course, it costs millions and millions of dollars, not so much if you're doing a maintenance here on Earth. I mean,
I'm sure that's probably still pretty expensive, but comparatively.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the grand scheme of things.
But tell me about this one, Jonathan.
So it's optical and near infrared. So we're talking visible light to near infrared. And it'll have a 39-meter main mirror.
That's big.
So the largest telescope in the world right now, we talked about it in the last episode, is the Gran Telescopio Canarias in Spain on the Canary Islands. And it has a 10.4-meter mirror. So this one will be a 39-meter mirror.
So that's like almost four times.
Yeah, it's enormous. So it'll be searching for Earth-like planets in the habitable zones, just like we were talking about with TESS, except it'll be doing it here on Earth. And it'll also be looking for it'll also be doing other projects in astronomy and cosmology, including a search into the universe's past. So very similar to what we had talked about with the James Webb.
Yeah.
And it's going to be at the, let's see if I can get this, Cerro Armazones, a mountain in Chile.
Is that Cerro or Cerro?
I would think it was Cerro.
It could be. It could be. My Latin languages are terrible. I'm more of a Germanic kind of guy. So it'll be a lot of hilarity with me trying to – hey, I'm just saying.
No,
that, that's
okay.
linguistic background.
Let's
yeah.
go.
Thought was good, Kinnick. So another enormous telescope planned for Chile is the Giant Magellan Telescope, which is going to have a 24.5-meter primary mirror. Although that mirror is actually going to be made up of 7 8.4-meter diameter segments, so it's another segmented mirror that collectively acts as one primary mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're in Chile, how about we visit the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope? That's
do let's.
Yeah, because it's going to be awesome. It's got a 3.2 gigapixel camera.
Whoa.
Forget your megapixels.
I don't even understand what that means, but okay. Yeah, well, I mean, I do, but that's just very, that's beyond my personal conception of, yes, okay.
This camera is going to scan the entire sky twice a week in panoramic shots. So you're going to get the entire view of the night sky from this perspective in Chile twice a week. And it's going to help us make a really detailed sky map, which could potentially lead to billions of discoveries of new bodies from stars to asteroids. And according to one researcher who works on the project, it will be the first time that astronomers have cataloged more objects than there are living people on Earth.
Wow.
So, very exciting. Also, you know, being able to detect those asteroids, very important, just as I was kind of alluding to that earlier in the podcast. But one of the things that a lot of people have brought to our attention is that, you know, asteroids have a potential of colliding with Earth. We've heard about this kind of thing several times over the last few years. And we don't have a whole lot of contingency plans for what to do in order to avoid such a thing, because if it's a large enough asteroid, that can be an extinction-level event,
mm-hmm.
right? Even if it doesn't directly cause enough damage to wipe out all life, it may indirectly cause it. So being able to detect these asteroids earlier gives us the opportunity to come up with a plan to move the asteroid out of the way, which is the most likely choice that we would have, the solution to that problem. Less likely would be sending up Bruce Willis to blow it up with, like, a nuclear bomb, because that probably wouldn't do us any good.
No.
I mean, we could try.
Well, you know.
I would hate to lose Bruce Willis.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Have you seen the last two Die Hard movies?
Oh, no.
I mean,
oh,
I'm just
this.
Saying. So, although those, I can't really blame Bruce Willis for
hey,
those.
Speaking of Bruce Willis, let's talk about biceps.
Yeah, we talked about Bicep 2 in our last episode, and Lauren yeah. and I talked about Bicep 2 quite a bit when
okay.
we did our update.
Super brief refresher. What is Bicep 2 and what does it do?
It looks for the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's specifically looking for polarization to give an indication for the presence of gravitational waves, which would in turn be a support for the inflation model of the Big Bang Theory. Lauren and I talked about how some of the findings that came out of an announcement that we heard back in March
from the BICEP team have since been not disproven, but certainly called into question due to the amount of space dust, which might have been mucking up the sensors.
Right. So BICEP 2 did all of its work from 2010 to 2012, I think. And BICEP 3 would be the next phase. It would be the next cosmic microwave background radiation observatory, really.
That one's at the South Pole.
South Pole, yep. And it will have 2,560 detectors operating at a 100 gigahertz frequency. And it'll, again, be studying the same thing that the BICEP 2 array studied. And the hope is that even if the information from BICEP 2 pans out to be less spectacular than what we first believed, this will be able to look for the trace evidence of gravitational waves that might have been, you know, somewhat boosted by space dust. But we'll be able to get more to the truth of the matter, is the hope.
Okay, I got another one.
Okay.
Perhaps to blow your mind with.
Yep.
Why don't we put telescopes on the moon?
What, to look back at the Earth? Peeping Tom.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. That might happen. I mean, who knows? That could happen. No. So we talked in the last podcast and a little bit in this one, I think, about some of the problems with having observatories here on Earth. You've got to deal with moisture in the atmosphere that gets in the way, dust, light pollution, all kinds of things like that. If you're talking about an optical telescope,
there's a lot of atmospheric
stuff
distortion
you have to see through.
Yeah.
So you have to place your observatories very carefully. You want to put them like at a high altitude in a very dry place.
Sure. And even if you're talking about like infrared telescopes are kind of poor on Earth because the heat of the Earth is going to mess stuff up.
Right. They have to be very sensitive. And the same thing is true if you're talking about radio telescopes. I mean, we have radio telescopes here on Earth, but they get interference from things on
from
Earth.
From all of the radio waves on Earth.
I mean, there's a lot of trouble.
I mean, we're using different frequencies, sure, but there's just...
I think I mentioned in the last podcast that I had read something a while ago while I was researching a blog post, I think it was for last year, that if you were to stand on the surface of the moon and activate a cellular telephone, that would create a signal that radio astronomers on Earth would consider pretty strong.
You would also have terrible reception, and you would very quickly die.
Well,
I think you made the same joke the last time I said that.
I made
that.
The die joke last time.
Oh, okay.
Because you were talking about you wouldn't necessarily die. I'm like, look, your smartphone, it's the capacitive touchscreen.
They've all heard it before, Jonathan.
Yeah, but Lauren hasn't.
This is just for us. Anyway, so these things have to be very sensitive, and what are you going to do? How do you shield them from all of the radio frequency activity on the Earth?
So,
well, one idea is put a giant hunk of rock between the Earth that's generating all these radio signals and these radio telescopes.
So you're thinking of actually having all the telescopes on the far side of the moon.
Right.
Which is not, by the way, the dark side of the moon, at least not all the time.
No. Light still hits it.
Yes. Yeah.
Just not when we can see it.
Right, because
we don't see it.
The moon is tidally locked with Earth. So that means the same face of the moon faces the Earth all the time, but all surfaces of the moon at some point or another get light from the sun.
Right. Confusing the fact that there is a permanent far side of the moon with the misconception that there's a permanent dark side of the moon is kind of like how a baby thinks if you cover its eyes, it has disappeared.
That's not true. You're blowing my mind here, Joe.
No,
I still operate under that.
Light can fall on things even if we don't see them. Yeah. So the moon goes all the way around. It gets sun on both sides.
Yes, but it does not. It does have a side that is permanently facing away from the Earth. And in fact, the first time we saw that was when the Apollo mission circled behind, was in lunar orbit, and they took pictures of the surface, which were really kind of creepy looking. A lot of craters. But now the talk is about putting telescopes on that side. Like you were saying, Joe, it's completely isolated from all the interference that would be generated on Earth. And you don't have to worry about the atmospheric distortion.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have different types of telescopes. And in fact, we've heard proposals for things like radio telescopes and optical telescopes on the surface of the moon, on the far side. which would be pretty cool. It's also a huge challenge. I mean, it's not easy for us to, obviously, we haven't gone back to the moon with a manned mission since the 70s. So, you know, it's not easy for us to do this necessarily, but I think most of the proposals I saw suggested using rovers and to deploy.
And assemble. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you'd be using robots, not actual people, to set these things up. But yeah, it's kind of cool. There are some issues. One of them is that if you're using a radio telescope, you have to power the telescope, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how do you generate power on the
moon?
Solar? Except then the sun is actually emitting radio waves. So the only time you would be able to use the telescope is when you're getting the most interference.
Hmm.
So what you would need is some form of power source.
If you had some kind of battery packs or something, then you could charge when it's not in use and use the telescope when it's...
That's a possibility.
There's that. The other one that I remember reading was proposed, I think it was earlier this year, was the idea that you could make this base near the South Pole of the moon. And so mounting solar arrays on the peaks of the South Pole of the moon, they would constantly receive sunlight in all directions.
Uh-huh. And then having something down in a crater, perhaps, where it wouldn't be...
Yeah, just so slightly off to the other side where they're shielded from the sun is where you would have your telescope array.
Yeah.
I've also heard of using nuclear pellets to power these, essentially the same way that a lot of our Curiosity rovers.
Yeah.
I think we should get a lot of nuclear power on the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, just in general. I mean, even if we're not really using it, I think that the more... nuclear waste stations we can have
if
up there,
nothing,
the better.
If nothing else, it's going to provide the fodder for numerous James Bond films down
right?
the road, which
right?
is really what we're all aiming for here at Forward Thinking.
Okay, speaking of kind of James Bond-sounding concepts, this next one sounds so much like science fiction to me, and it's a real thing that's happening, and I adore it so much. So there's a concept for a lunar liquid mirror telescope. We don't have one of these on the moon yet, but some do exist on Earth. And the idea is to use a reflective liquid like mercury in a rotating dish instead of a traditional, you know, solid aluminized glass mirror.
Okay.
And so the rotation of the dish, if it's done, you know, very precisely, will place gravitational and inertial forces on the liquid that lets it form this uniform, perfect parabolic shape for reflection that's also self-correcting, so you wouldn't get any of that Hubble-esque trouble with imperfect mirrors that cost billions to replace. And like I said, there are a few on Earth. The biggest is the Large Zenith Telescope, which is in British Columbia in Canada. It's almost 20 feet across. Not too shabby. And putting one of these suckers on the moon would be pretty rad because, you know, the moon, as we have said, right, doesn't have that pesky Earth atmosphere. But it also would create a bunch of problems. For example, the temperature would make mercury freeze, thereby not making it a very useful liquid telescope.
Right.
And they'd also need to design a new dish support system that would let it rotate smoothly. The Large Zenith, for example, uses an air cushion, which would not work without, you know, air.
Yeah.
So that's problematic.
The lunar atmosphere is sparse, to be fair.
they're talking about using like a superconductor electromagnetic. Like,
gotcha. So sort of the quantum lock that we see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Totally. Got it. And the really cool thing, other than the fact that it's a mirror made of liquid, is that they're a lot cheaper than solid mirror telescopes. You know, they can't be rotated the way that we do mirror, you know, traditional mirrors,
sure,
because the liquid would spill out.
Gotcha.
Which would also make it less useful. But in the end, it really simplifies construction. And a moon base would be really great for infrared telescopy because the base temperature is so low, you know, we wouldn't run into the same kind of trouble that we do on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there hasn't been a whole lot of buzz about this kind of thing since around 2008, but at the time people were projecting possible launches out into the 2020s or so. So I think that we should all keep our ears out and see if anyone's been working on it.
That's really cool. Yeah.
You know, I wonder if the idea of having telescopes on the moon is one of those that might not be self-justifying, but if we ever were to create a colony at one of the poles of the moon, it would be sort of a logical extension of that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of focus to use the moon as sort of the proving grounds for
deeper
explorations into space, particularly a manned mission to Mars. I mean, NASA's current proposed approach involves asteroids and the moon as sort of a stepping stone to get to Mars.
Yeah.
So it totally makes sense.
And they're also talking about using the polar regions of the moon for this one.
Yeah.
Because that's, I think, basically just the best place to put this kind of stuff. So.
But now, guys, I want to take a look at the future and ask a question about the limits of telescope technology.
So you're going to look through a telescope at the future of telescopes to see the limit of telescopes.
No, when you look through a telescope, you're looking at the past.
That's true. The further back you look, the further back you look.
Actually, well, I'm going to look backwards through a telescope at the future.
Oh, hey. Right. Okay.
Now
okay.
It all makes sense. All right.
Okay, so I want to know what constrains the upper limit of telescope resolution, because we can see a certain distance out. I mean, telescopes obviously have better resolution than they used to, but what if we want to see the kinds of things that are just absolutely beyond the limits of what we can see today? What if we want to be able to directly image the surface of planets in solar systems halfway across the galaxy? What prevents us from doing that?
Do we just need really big lenses?
Yeah, that's the question. Basically, I wanted to know, is it a hard limit imposed by physics? Is it just something that you just can't do that? Or is it something about the nature of telescopes, a technological problem that we could actually achieve if we just build better and better telescopes, larger sizes, more precision engineering of the mirrors? And I actually passed this request along to some of our contacts at NASA and got a really exciting answer.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, yeah, the answer came back from Dr. John Mather, the 2006 Nobel laureate in physics and the senior project scientist on the James Webb Space Telescope. And he sent me back this answer. It said as follows. Telescopes are limited by the wave nature of light so that a point-like object appears to have an angular size of at least lambda divided by d, where lambda is the wavelength, meaning the wavelength of the light, and D is the diameter of the telescope. So that means if you want a sharper image and you can't change the wavelength of the light you're studying, you absolutely have to have a bigger telescope, even if you're building it in outer space. So I think what he's saying there is that we can resolve greater images farther and farther out there, but there is a size restriction. I mean, the problem is you've got to build bigger and bigger mirror arrays. Mm-hmm. And we've already talked earlier in the podcast about how hard that is to do.
Sure.
And to get them into space, especially. Dr. Mather says, but here on the ground, we have another problem. The atmosphere we love to breathe is always changing and making the images we see in the telescope dance around. With tremendous effort, we can build equipment to compensate for that. It's called adaptive optics, and it can work quite well, but we still need a bigger telescope if we want to get a sharper image.
Hmm.
Interesting.
So really the limit is size.
Gotcha.
And
well, size and whatever light you're using to study. So
exactly right.
If
there is a
something.
Physics limit,
yeah.
But it's not a physics limit on the resolution that we can see ultimately. It's a physics limit that constrains what we can see based on the size of the telescope.
Yeah, based on what we can build or have built so far, rather.
Interesting. Yeah. So that's really cool. I'm glad that you were able to get that answer. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So big thanks to Dr. Mather, and also thanks to Maggie Mazzetti at NASA for putting us in touch with him. That was a really interesting thing to learn.
Yeah.
I feel like we could probably say this every episode, but thanks, NASA.
Yep, I agree. We can say that, and now we will.
One, two, three.
Thanks, NASA!
Well, and thank you guys. You listeners out there who are listening to our show, I hope that you really enjoyed this episode. Remember, you can get in touch with us and let us know what topics you would like us to cover in the future, about the future. Let us know on Twitter or Google Plus or Facebook. We have the handle FWThinking over at Twitter and Google Plus. Just search FWThinking at Facebook. It'll pop right up. And let us know what you think. We want to hear from you. And you'll hear from us again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.